lot of them have a celebration. No other month has the concept of increasing Simcha except for Adar. There has to be some sort of Simcha of Adar which kind of goes beyond other celebrations. You know, Pesach is a happy time, and Sukkot is happy, and Shavuos is happy, and lots of things are happy. Hanukkah is happy, but Purim seems to be the happiest, and seems to be a time of incredible joy. And the question is, how do we understand this amazing joy of Purim, which seems to go beyond other holidays? I think this joy has a lot of levels to it. I think it's very profound, and there's many, many ways to understand it. So we'll talk about a few different concepts today. But I say every single year that in many of our minds, you know, Purim has become very much a kiddie holiday. You know, a lot of focus on the kids and the costumes and the candy, and you walk into a shul, and a lot of the focus in the shul emphasis is on the kids, which is nice, and it's fine, and it's very positive for the kids. But we have to know that Purim was not instituted for kids. It's instituted for everybody. And it happens to be a very, very deep and holy day, a very profound day, a very, very spiritual day, if we could tap into its meaning and what it stands for. I mentioned, I think, every year that to the extent that the Arizal, the founder of modern-day Kabbalah, Kabbalistic thought, he compares Purim to Yom Kippur. Yom Kippurim has the word in it, Purim. And he says that Purim and Kippur are kind of two sides of the same coin. You know, so we know how holy Yom Kippur is. Nobody would ever see Yom Kippur as a kiddie holiday. That's for sure. So Purim as well certainly is not a kiddie holiday, and Purim has, in the spiritual realm, has the same power on some level as Yom Kippur. So it's always important to keep in mind as we celebrate Purim. The idea of Marvin B'Simcha, increasing our Simcha. So in Hebrew, we have many, many synonyms for happiness. But in Hebrew, which is Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, that means that every synonym has a different nuance to it. There's no two words that mean the same exact thing. So as you talk about, you know, the word Simcha, so there's a concept of Simcha, Sason, Gila, Chedva, the whole song you might sing at a wedding, right? So, so each one has its own separate nuance of meaning, what it exactly means. So the question is, our goal during Adar is to increase Simcha. And we often refer to happiness as Simcha, but what is the idea of Simcha exactly? How does it differ from the other words in Hebrew for happiness? And every Yontif really has a Simcha to it. There's a mitzvah of rejoicing in every Yontif. Samachta d'chagechish, rejoice on a holiday. And it's always referred to as Simcha. And every Yontif brings about a certain feeling of Hashem's care and providence over the world. So what is it about Simcha that associates even more so with Adar, and what does Simcha mean? So let's start with that point. The Malbim, who's one of the more recent but very famous commentators on the Torah and the Tanakh, he's very famous for talking about synonyms and differentiating between the synonyms, what they all mean. So the Malbim has a piece discussing the difference between Simcha, Sason, Gila, and he has a few other terms that he discusses as well. But for our purposes, we translate them all as joy and happiness and celebration, but in English the words don't really have that much of a difference. So the Malbim says that the idea of Simcha, it means it's an ongoing inner feeling of happiness, of contentment, of fulfillment. The idea of Sason, he says, Sason is an outward expression of happiness. The idea, he says, of Gil or Gila, that's like a spurt of joy. You know, like you have one thing happens and you have a quick spurt of happiness, but it's not necessarily going to be an ongoing happiness. But Simcha refers to an ongoing feeling of inner contentment. That's what Simcha really means. It's not an outward display. You can have Simcha but not be dancing and singing and smiling. But inside you feel content. You feel fulfilled. You feel happy. There you go. But it's an ongoing feeling and it's an inner feeling. The way we achieve this feeling usually is the understanding that when we feel that we are fulfilled as people, that we are complete, that we're supported, that we're cared for, that gives a feeling of Simcha, because we feel on the inside that things are in order. And even though it might be externally we haven't displayed that, but that's because we're not dancing and singing every moment of our lives. But deep down, we have this sense of Simcha, of happiness, which means that we feel fulfilled. We feel content. We feel complete in some way, and that's brings Simcha. And the more complete and fulfilled that we feel, the more Simcha we have. That's how it all fits together, that concept of Simcha. So every Yontif has this concept of Simcha. Every single time we celebrate a holiday, we are rejoicing in the fact that Hashem is there for us, and He cares for us, and we feel, as a Jewish nation, supported and guided and cared for and protected, and that brings a simcha. Because, you know, every holiday stresses our unique role as Jews, that we have a special privilege, a special role in this world, and therefore that brings simcha, because on the inside we know that we have a special place in Hashem's world. That gives us simcha. And we see that God performs miracles for us and saves us, that gives us simcha, because we feel that we are protected and we are cared for. And that's true with any holiday. The big difference between Purim and other holidays is the following. Purim is the holiday where we focus very, very much on the fact that God is hidden throughout all the miracles. The heroine of Purim is Esther, which the rabbis connect with the word haster astir, I will hide my face, conceal my face. Because in the times of Purim, God is concealed. When you read the Megillah, you see nothing in it which is miraculous, nothing in it which is all that impressive, except for the whole story as a whole at the end when we're saved. But as you're going along the way in the Megillah, everything is just normal events in the Persian Empire of, you know, the king and his servants and his queen, and there's nothing there which is out of the ordinary. Everything is very, very plain and ordinary. You don't see God performing miracles. When you read the story of leaving Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, you see miracles. You see 10 plagues, you see the splitting of the sea, you see the food falling from the sky, and you see all sorts of things happening. Clouds of glory. When you read the story of Purim, there's nothing there which is all that impressive to us. But when you look at the whole picture of Purim, it's quite impressive. Because somehow, through the humdrum every single day life, and everybody making their own decisions, somehow God created a miracle. And when you connect the dots, you see how it all came out at the end. When you see Vashti killed, Esther is chosen, Mordechai uncovers an assassination plot, everything which you see, you can connect the dots and figure out the miracle at the end. But as each piece happens, all we see is consumed. We see God concealed. We don't see God exposing himself. So the expression of Purim, of God caring for us, is caring for us in a time of hidden miracles. Now, open miracles, on the one hand, are incredible because they're open. You know, we see them. We see God doing supernatural, amazing things. But that's not everyday life. Those are few and far between, events of open miracles. But the everyday life, when God runs the world, happens through the hidden. Happens through natural events. Somehow God's moving the pieces and guiding us and bringing us to the right place. So Purim is this expression of Anochi Haster Astir. I'm going to hide my face, God says. And even through the concealment, you're going to find me caring for you and performing these miracles. So Hashem saves us despite the fact that we have little merit, there's no miracles occurring, it's a time of difficulty and struggle in the history of the Jewish people, but yet Hashem is still there supporting us, and that gives us a tremendous sense of simcha. Because, you know, when somebody is next to you helping you out, you feel happy, I feel somebody's there for me. But when you're on your own, but somebody's still helping you out from the powers that be, they're helping you out, even when you don't see them around you, you feel even happier, because I know I'm cared for even when I don't see the person there for me. I feel I'm always cared for. The very fact that we have somebody that is there to support or protect us, even if they're not next to us right now, gives us a sense of happiness. So if somebody is only there for you when they're with you, and then when they're gone, they don't care about you anymore, well, that's not much. That gives you a temporary happiness. That's not a deep, lasting happiness. But we know you have friends and you have family there at all times to support you. At that point, even when they're not around, you feel that happiness because I know I'm supported by others. I know people care for me. I know that I'm protected by others. And that's the concept of Purim. On Pesach, in the story of leaving Mitzrayim, we saw God with us. We saw He's there holding our hands, leading us over the sea, etc. On Purim, we didn't see Him there. But we learned that even though I didn't see Him, He was still helping us out. And that gives us a much deeper sense of happiness in that we feel that we are content. So we feel we are protected and fulfilled, and we are guided, and we're going in the right direction.
Can you connect Pesach to Purim?
Certainly. I mean, certainly, but kind of as opposites. Not as the whole story of Purim happened on Pesach. Haman was killed on Pesach, right? The 3 days of fasting began Erev Pesach, the first day, and the second day of Pesach. That was the whole story happened then, because it really stands up as a big contrast that there is. The Pesach is a time of open miracles, and Purim is the same level of miracle, but in a hidden way.
Can I help you with this one?
Please, go ahead.
When you study Megillat Esther, you have to put it in this correct context. You have here not just Megillat Esther, but a number of contemporary books, Echa, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and also Divrei Hayamim. If you go and you check, they explicitly talk about the celebration of Pesach. I'm trying to think if it was with Daniel or Ezra in there, and exactly in the same context. It's clearly.
Okay.
And to Pesach, the other connection is in Daniel, you have Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and you have the seven there, which ultimately becomes the 7 years he has, something that's connected to the dream of Paro.
Okay, interesting. Okay, thank you. I think there are more connections also. I mean, when we say Mishnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, when Adar begins, we increase our Simcha. So Rashi explains, he says it means because of the miracles of Purim and Pesach, because they come back to back. Those 2 months are back to back to one another.
And those are the two major holocausts or tragedies which lead onward in our history. Major, major events.
Major events that really move us on to the next stage.
Tragedies,
you mean the potential tragedies?
Tragedies. They're interconnected.
You mean the potential tragedies that we were saved from, is what you mean? Sort
no,
of.
It's turning points in Judaism.
Turning points. Okay, we'll call them turning points. Okay. So, even as we see Haman rising to power, and we are in exile in Persia, the world around us is collapsing. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, there's a decree to kill every single one of us. Even then, we see the providence of Hashem caring for us at that moment. Mordechai is somebody that recognizes this. Now, Mordechai is somebody who's able to see through the concealment and know that we're going to be saved. Because the Megillah tells us, and Mordechai tells Esther, he says, you have to go in and plead for the Jewish people. And Esther says, you know, if you go in, you're not called, you can be killed. And he says to her, he says, you know what? Don't think you can hide in the palace, because this is your chance. He says, if you don't go in, we're going to be saved one way or the other. God will save us. If it's not through you, you're going to suffer from it, and someone else will save us. But Mordechai was 100% confident that even though we were sitting in a time of concealment, and we did not see God's hand in the events, that he would for sure save us no matter what. He was confident.
Was he considered a prophet?
Mordechai was a prophet. I don't know if this was actual prophecy right here. Mordechai is one of the prophets, though. In the list of prophets, we have Mordechai is one of the prophets.
And the word that he uses, Al Tidami Nafshech, Dam, that the blood of the Jews would be on your hands if you don't take action.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. This says, but we will be saved elsewhere, and in some other way. The Netziv, one of the great commentators in the Torah, so he writes, discussing Amalek. You know, Haman descends from Amalek. Amalek is a nation that we are supposed to destroy. They stand in this world for the polar opposite of what we stand for. And we've discussed Amalek in the past, a separate discussion about who they are and what they stand for. But in the account of Amalek, right before the Torah discusses Amalek coming to fight against the Jews in the desert, so the Jews ask the question, "Yesh Hashem bekirbenu im ayin." Is God with us or not? And then immediately the Torah says, Vayavo Amalek. Amalek comes and they fought us. So we see there's a connection between this question of God, is God with us or not, to Amalek coming in. So what was the question? It's a very strange question. Because they were sitting in the desert. They were experiencing all these miracles. They just left Egypt. They just crossed the sea. And suddenly they have a question, is God with us or not? I mean, it seems ridiculous in our minds. Like, what are they asking? Of course God is with them. I mean, if you just saw the sea split and all the Egyptians killed in the sea, you know God's with you. What are they asking? So then Tziv writes, he says that the question they had was that we understand that God is with us when these miracles happen. When we saw the sea split, we knew God was with us. When we saw the 10 plagues occur, we knew God was with us. But now we're moving into everyday life. I mean, they're still in the desert, but, you know, relatively it was everyday life. We don't see God in everyday life. Who says God is with us on a regular Tuesday afternoon, when no seas are splitting around us, and there's no frogs jumping around, and there's no hail falling from the sky? Is God with us now or not? And that was the question. And then Tziv writes that that really was the point that the Jews were struggling with, and Amalek came to attack based on that doubt. So how does that connect to our story? Because, you know, Haman comes from Amalek. And the whole story of Purim is supposed to teach us that even when you don't see the open miracles, God is still with you. It's supposed to teach us that that question that you asked that caused the Amalek to come in, the Purim story is going to come and answer that question. And that's what it does. The Purim story shows us that, you know, even when God is totally concealed and the events look like they're just humdrum, everyday, boring events, God is still directing those events. So, you know, children are typically happy. Why are children typically happy? Because a child who has a healthy, you know, supportive family they feel that they're taken care of. They don't have all the worries of the world on their heads, and they feel I'm supported, you know, I'm content, people are there for me, so they're happy. We as Jews, we mentioned a few weeks ago, Banim Atem Hashem Elokeichem, you know, we're God's children. And we have to recognize the fact that God is always there to care for us no matter what. We have His support, we have His care, we're never abandoned, and there's no greater joy than this. When you take into heart the lesson of Purim, that even when things look like they are so tragic and so difficult, and we seem so abandoned by God, it's not true. God is still there, and even through the concealment and through the difficult events of Purim, the story shows us that God is there, always there for us, supporting us, guiding us, and bringing us in the right direction. That's where we're going. We're never lacking, we're never abandoned. And that's part of the big simcha of the month of Adar, is taking into heart the lesson of Purim, which is that even when I don't see God caring for me, He's still caring for me. And there's no greater simcha than that. That's one of the greatest feelings, and that's an ongoing feeling of content, because we know as people, every day of our lives, 120 years, God is there for us. So that means we have to take to heart that lesson of Purim. It's very interesting. Commentators point out that in Hebrew, not only the synonyms make a difference, but even the way you pronounce a word, you can make connections with it. So the word simcha, the shoresh, samich, sin, mem, ches, relates to the word samach, to support. So mech is to support something. This will be supported by or supported upon. And simcha and sameach and samach, they relate. Because when you feel that you are supported, you feel simcha. If you feel that you are abandoned, you don't feel simcha. So those two words really connect. And it's a very important lesson for us that we have to know, no matter what's happening in our own lives and in the world around us, we always have God's support. And we shouldn't have any worries because of that. We have to do what we have to do. We have to live life and do the right things. But the simcha is still there. And that's the idea of Mishnah's Adar Marbim B'Simcha. You take the message of Purim, you take it to heart, and you become somebody who has a strong trust and faith in God. And that leads to an ongoing feeling of fulfillment and content in life.
It's very interesting, because in El Adon, they put Smechim exactly in the place of the Samach.
The Samach, yeah, right. Right. You see them interchangeable very often.
Dyslexic.
Right. Right, that's true, but you pronounce them, they come from the same parts of the mouth. It's an entomological, I think, is the word, connection.
Correct.
Entomological. Okay, thank you. So this is one approach to the Simcha of Adar, and I want to take a deeper approach. This approach, I'm basing it on a book called Das Shlomo, written by, it's the ideas of Rav Shlomo Volbi Zatzal. He was a great thinker and you know, a great sage in Eretz Yisrael. He passed away, I mean, 10 years ago or so. But he has a kind of a deeper approach to the concept I want to try to discuss a little bit. And it really goes back to the essence of a human being. And we'll see how it fits into Purim in a second. But we know that Hashem created every single person pure. Elokim baras Adam Yashar. Hashem created us straight and pure. It's our fault. It says, Heim bikshu chishvonos rabim. It's our fault. You know, we confuse things. We bemuddle ourselves, you know, we corrupt ourselves, we block our straightness and our purity. But we know that where does simcha come from? It's another place where one is able to achieve happiness. It says, O Yishrei Lev Simcha. Those who are straight of heart have happiness. When we start clouding our hearts to all these problems and doubts and anxieties and difficulties and worries, so then we lose our state of simcha. But if our hearts remain pure and the connection to God is felt, and we tap into who we really are, we feel happy, we feel content, we feel that we understand our lives, we understand the world. That's Yishrei Lev Simcha. So the natural state of a human being is that we should have happiness. That's natural. Happiness is natural. It's the pure, natural, straight heart feels Simcha. Yishrei Lev Simcha. The straight heart feels Simcha. The heart connects to God. The heart is really our source, our energy, in a physical level. The heart's our vibrance, our energy, it's our life force. The heart keeps pumping. That's our the dynamic part of the body is the heart. Our connection to God, our desire to do right, the aspirations to achieve and do the right things on a spiritual level, a human's greatness, so they should really pump through our being like our heart pumps the blood through our body. That's what it should be. And when you have a pure heart on a spiritual level, that means that your connection to God is pumping through you. And you feel totally ignited and inspired and motivated. And you want to do the right things. And you feel happy in life because you're accomplishing and you're successful and you're producing. To the extent when your heart is pumping through you, you know, the blood's going through your veins at a physical level. And on a spiritual level, you have this connection to God pumping through the person. So you can fulfill through yourself. There's a verse that says, Libi basari yiranu el kel chai, that my heart and my flesh, they all sing in joy to God, to the living God. And we want our, it's not just our mouths or our minds, it's our heart and our flesh. When a person is totally inspired and motivated when it comes to being a good Jew and doing the right thing, you can have not just your mind and your mouth praising God, but your entire body is praising God because it's pumping through who you are. There are some people out there that we see that are just so ignited and so inspired people, such passionate people. You feel whatever they do, they're just, you know, they're connected to God and they're doing the right things all the time, helping others and, you know, always doing what needs to be done. But our problem is the heart can get blocked sometimes. You know, our heart can get blocked. We have something called, the rabbis describe something called timtum halev, that the heart can have a blockage. So we know about the physical heart blockage, you know, the clogged artery and the like. But also spiritual heart blockage. You know, your spiritual heart can be blocked. And then we can have things that clog it up, and then we can't feel that inspiration. There's something called orlas halev. The Torah has a verse that talks about that God will come and circumcise the covers of our hearts. Very similar to a bris, but on the heart. It doesn't mean a surgery, it's not a physical, but it's a spiritual thing. That a person can have their heart covered up by something. And one of the blessings that God says at the end of the day is that He will come circumcise our hearts, and our hearts will be pure, and we can get through that blockage. And then we'll feel sensitive, and we'll feel the spirituality once again. Unfortunately, very often we become numb. We become very physical people. We become numb to God. We could become less sensitive and less feeling to spirituality, to doing the right things, to God, to Torah. And we can attribute it to these concepts of the blockage over our hearts. The straight, pure heart senses God and feels happiness. It's the heart that gets blocked. That heart can't sense it. So, therefore, the spiritual blood doesn't pump through our veins. You know, just like the physical heart, God forbid, gets blocked and the blood can't pump through properly. So through our spiritual heart, if it gets blocked with spiritual clogs, so the spirituality can't pump through our veins. And then we feel distant from God and we don't feel it in our actions. So this brings us to a very important concept, which is that a person can have in their mind all the right things to do. Our minds can be totally straight. You know, we can know what's right, know what's true, know what's honest, moral, ethical, proper. We can know in our minds everything. But if it can't translate from our minds down to our hearts, if our hearts become corrupt, even if our minds are straight, we have a big problem now. And that's the problem. You know, like we said, the verse says, Yishrei lev simcha. Simcha comes through the straight of heart. But if you have a straight mind, a corrupt heart, you're not going to achieve happiness. You're not going to do the right things. Because, you know, really deep down, it's very hard to overcome our hearts. You know, our heart stands for, you know, our emotions. Heart stands for our drives, our ambitions. And even if our mind says X is right, our heart says, I don't want to do that. So more often than not, our heart wins out. I mean, more often than not, our emotions or our ambitions win out over our minds. Even at the time where our mind does win out, we're not happy doing it. Because since that goes against our emotions, it goes against who we are, so I do it because my mind forces myself to do it. I don't want to do this, I'm really not interested, I hate it, you know, it's boring to me, or I'd rather do something else, but it's the right thing, so I'll do it. So we do it begrudgingly, and at the end we say, okay, that was really difficult, but I'm glad I did it intellectually, but I didn't feel happy about it necessarily. I may feel happy that I was able to overcome myself in some way, but it's hard to live life like that. And
you
somebody lives life.
To the Megillat Esther on what you're saying.
Eventually, we'll get there.
What's the meaning of a Chashverosh?
Chashverosh, yeah. You say the Rosh.
Halfway there. Lachush is to sense. The Rosh is head, to analyze. So Achashverosh has to sense the sincerity of the people who come before him, and he has to analyze their motives.
Interesting. Okay. Very interesting connection. That one I never thought of before. Very interesting connection. So we do right. If our brain is forcing us to do right, so we might do right, might not do right. But we don't enjoy life that way. Life is very difficult that way. One of the a great Jewish thinker was once asked, you know, how could it be that the Jews, I mean, this is a question we all have. If you read through the Torah, the Jews in the desert, they have a lot of difficulties. They saw God's miracles, but yet they're complaining, and they sinned, and there was a golden calf, and there were spies, and all these bad things they did. But yet they saw God's miracles. So, a great Jewish thinker, Rav Yerucham Levavitz, he once said that it's very clear from a verse in Psalms. And we say it every Friday night in Kabbalah Shabbos. Arba'im shana kup bedor. God says, for 40 years, I was angry at the entire generation. V'omar, am tovei levavim. I said, they are people who are of stray hearts. Their hearts wander, and they didn't know my ways. So he explained that they didn't know the ways in the heart. Because they were tawei levav, their hearts went astray, so they didn't know God's ways in their hearts. They knew God's ways in their heads, but they didn't know God's ways in their hearts. And it was, the issue was that they had it intellectually, but they didn't have it emotionally. They didn't have it in their feelings and their emotions, they only had it up in their heads. So that was something which was a struggle for Jews in the desert. Struggle for us nowadays as well. It's a big struggle. And a lot of times we know what's right, but doing what's right is a different story. Even though we know what's right. Doing what's right is very hard sometimes. Now, how does this relate to Purim? Make some connections to Purim. The nation of Amalek, again, Haman descends from Amalek. And the story of Purim is very much bound up with the story of the Jews fighting Amalek. And one of the negative traits of Amalek is the following. If you look at the way that the nations are described after the splitting of the sea, we say this in Az Yashir, in the Song of the Sea, it was said that Shem Amim Yirgazun, all the nations heard about the miracles of the Exodus and they trembled. They were terrified of God. The settlers of the land of the Plishtim, the Philistines, were snatched up in terror. All those who settled in Canaan, their hearts melted in fear. They saw God's miracles and they trembled. They had such a fear of God. The nation missing of that list is Amalek. Amalek heard of the miracles too. No, there's no reason they didn't hear the miracles. It was in the papers. Everyone knew about it. But they did not end up with the same emotion as everyone else. They didn't tremble in fear. They didn't melt. They weren't terrified of God. They said, it doesn't make a difference to us. Now, why not? Why did it make a difference to them? Because Amalek's job in this world, as a nation, God put them in this world, I always talk about it as a spiritual force. It's not only a physical nation. It's a spiritual force as well. The spiritual force has roots far beyond that actual human being in that nation. But if they're put in this world in order, their job is to keep God up there, not let him come down here. So on the one hand, it's keeping God up in the heavens, not letting him come down and do anything on earth. And it's also keeping God in our brains, not in our hearts. It's the same thing. The way that the rabbis describe Amalek says that they were Yodea Ribono, they knew their master, Umarba, but yet they rebelled. So they had a knowledge of God, but yet they rebelled against God. Well, how could that be? How could you know God and rebel against him? The answer is because it's only intellectual, and it doesn't go into your heart and your actions. So it's like the Jews in the desert. They were able to know God in their minds, but they didn't know God in their hearts. Yeah?
Regarding Pesach, God hardened Pharaoh's heart, right?
At a certain point, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So Pharaoh then wasn't considered as cruel as Amalek, was it?
He wasn't, you know. Pharaoh, it seems, lived afterwards, and some say he became the righteous king of Nineveh, you know, in the story of Jonah later on, in Jonah. So, you know, Pharaoh could be, in the beginning he was very stubborn. He certainly was wicked, but nowhere near as wicked as we would consider Amalek. I think that's definitely a true statement.
Thank you.
But the Amalek seems to know about God, but they wanted to rebel. So that means that they had an intellectual understanding, but they didn't let it impact who they were. It couldn't impact their actions or their emotions. God remained kind of a concept, an ideal, something like out there, very floaty, something up in the sky. But God wasn't allowed to come down and have his presence or purity here on earth. Amalek comes to attack right before we got the Torah, because the Torah is the way in which we're supposed to bring God down into our lives, into the world. Amalek couldn't stand for that. How could you bring God into this world? God can stay up there. Now, he can stay up in the sky all he wants, but to have him come down here on earth, that we can't tolerate. Very interestingly, this is a bit of a Kabbalistic concept, but at the end of the story of Amalek, so Moshe relates that God, as it were, swore to destroy Amalek. And the way God swears to destroy Amalek, he says, Yad al kes ka, that my hand swears upon the throne of God. And the name of God used there is not the full name of Yud Ke Vav Ke, the four-letter name, but only has the first two letters, Yud and He. Yad al kes ka. And the rabbis describe that because Amalek puts a limitation into the world, that when Amalek is around, God, as it were, doesn't fully present himself in this world. And Kabbalistically, if you look at God's four-letter name, and this obviously is a much deeper discussion, the first two letters represent God's existence up in the heavens, and the second two kind of bring him down to earth. So Amalek, you know, they keep God up in the heavens. That's what they try to do. So when Amalek is around, God is referred to as just Yud and Hey, the first letter of his name. But the letter, the second two letters, the Vav and the Hey, Amalek tries to limit those letters. He says, God can't come down and connect the world. And a very simple understanding of those letters, that the third letter is a Vav. Vav means and. It's a connecting letter. Because that's the point of connection of God from the heavens down to the earth. That's what that represents. So this is a very deep Kabbalistic concept, but we understand on a very simple level that Amalek limits God's name to the part that relates to the heavens and doesn't let God come down. They try not to let God come down here on earth. That'd be sensed on earth. So it's in the intellect, not in the heart, in the heavens, not in the earth. It's all the same concept. The Torah describes also that Amalek says, Asher karcha baderach, they happen upon you on the road. And the rabbis say that the word karcha might mean happen upon you. But also it's the word kar. Kar in Hebrew is cold. And Amalek came and they cooled us off. So what could that mean? Somebody who is serving God with the heart, we refer to them in English. You know, they're a very warm person. You know, they're very, very passionate. If somebody's very distant, you know, very, very, you know, you talk about somebody who's very, very intellectual and doesn't have much emotion, it's a very cold person, a very cold personality. They're very distant from you. So Amalek's job was to come and make us cold, cool us off, shakarcha, and make us that God remains in our heads and up in the sky, but nowhere in our hearts, nowhere here on earth. That was their goal, that they tried to do. And this is the challenge. The Jews had this challenge in the desert. We have this challenge this very day. The Jews in the desert struggle with this. As we said before, it says, "Am toi levav him." Their hearts were astray. Their minds may have been okay, but their hearts were astray. The rabbis refer to that generation as the Dor Dea, the generation of knowledge, which is in the mind. It's the Dor Dea. And we talk about them, the term used in the Torah constantly to describe their rebelliousness is their Am Keshe Oref, their stiff-necked nation. So what connects your mind to the rest of your body? It's the neck. It's the, you know, the spinal cord of the neck. This is the connecting point. So their necks were stiff. You know, things couldn't go from their head down to their body. Things stayed up in the head, then they get down. That was the idea of being stiff-necked. When you're stubborn, it means that you know something might be right, but you're not willing to do it because you're stubborn. You know in your head, so they have a kshei aura, if we say often, it means they're stiff-necked, means they're stubborn people. Because stubborn means, okay, you know, I'm not going to give in. You know, cause this is what I want to do, and even though I know it's right, I'm not going to let it impact my actions. This is who I am. This is what I do. It's being stubborn. So, in Rashi quotes a very interesting metaphor given by the sages. Let's read this metaphor. It's very relevant. The end of Parshas Beshalach, right when Amalek comes on the scene for the first time. So Rashi says that, so the Jews asked, is God with, like we said before, is God with us or not? So Rashi quotes, he says, Mashal. We have an analogy. There's a person who is holding his son on his shoulders, and he goes out on the road. So he picture a kid riding on his father's shoulders. So the kid looks, sees an item on the ground, and says, you know, Abba, Daddy, hand me the item. So the father says, okay, picks it up, gives it to the kid. Does it a second time, does it a third time. Then the father meets somebody else in the road, and the kid asks, have you seen my father? You know, it's on his father's shoulders. You see my father? So this is the metaphor given. So at that point, the father throws off the kid, and the dogs come and bite the kid. That's the end of the metaphor. You know, like off my shoulders, you know? But what's the concept? You know, the Jews from the desert, they're being supported by God 100%. And they say, you know, give us water, and give us food, and protect us. And then they get to this point, they say, is God with us or not? So God says, really? And he throws them off. But on a deeper level, this concept is the challenge of the Jews with Amalek. What's the concept? It's that the kid was aware of his father. He said, you see, he knew his father existed. He just didn't feel his father's constant involvement, support. So on his father's shoulders, he says, I'm totally aware I have a father. Where's my father? Yes, where's my father? I want to see him. That was something intellectual. But when it came down to real life, he didn't realize his father was right there under him. He didn't see it. So that's the same concept, is that things remain in our minds and not in our heart. So one of the major tasks on Purim is the following. On Purim, we have to recognize, you know, God's active role in life. God's not just a concept which is out there, but God is active in our lives. And it's not just intellectually, we have to feel God emotionally. You know, the part of the idea of joy, when you have joy, joy is not intellectual, joy is emotional. It goes on in the intellect. You can't be, I don't think you're happy in your intellect. You're happy in your emotion. It's an emotional happiness. So if we're able to allow this down into our hearts, not remain in our heads, if we can bring God and recognize God, you know, as the one carrying us, as the father carrying his kid on his shoulders, not leave God up in the heavens, but realize God's down here on earth, That kind of cracks the barrier to the heart. You know, we said the heart is clogged. Now, if we have a, if our heart is straight, literally lay the simcha. If your heart is straight, then you feel happiness. If your heart gets clogged up, and you don't recognize the purity of the heart and the connection of the heart to God, so then that's where we deal. That's where we have troubles. That's where we end up with difficulties. Well, on Purim, Purim is the holiday that celebrates the destruction of Amalek. Amalek's role is to keep God up in the intellect and up in the sky and not bring him down onto earth. On Purim is a day where we at least taste a little bit of the destruction of this force in the world. So it's a day where the heart should be kind of opened up. The heart's ready to be cleared. You know, it's like you've cleared your arteries out. Now your heart can be pumping strong once again. That's what Purim is about. It's a holiday of the heart. It's a day where one can really feel God and feel that emotion. And feel the idea of Purim is a day of total joy and total simcha and celebration. Because we're trying to bring real emotion into being Jews. You know, for better or for worse, a lot of things that we do are intellectual. And we put a lot of stress on studying Torah and understanding, which is very appropriate. But it's also important that we become emotional as Jews. We should feel passionate, feel emotional about what we're doing as Jews. We want to be emotional and passionate about doing the right things. We want to feel warmth, and we want to feel connection. We don't want to just be doing things out of rote and doing things out of our duty, and doing things because we our mind tells us they're right. We do them because we feel it. We feel in our bones that it's right. So one of the big things on Purim is it's a day that gives the opportunity to feel a true emotion and passion in being Jews. It offers that to us. To take pleasure in the things that we know in life, what do we take pleasure in? We take pleasure in things that we feel really connect with us, relate to us. You know, when you hear about some distant, far-off concept, so you say interesting, but you don't take joy, personal pleasure in it. But when you hear something, you do something that relates to you as a person, you feel it's pleasurable. You feel very happy about it because it's me. It's who it fits me. It's who I am. So Purim, it's the goal of Purim is that we try to incorporate this concept into our lives, that everything, it's not just that I do it because my mind tells me to do it, but I try to make it emotional. I try to feel a true, real, passionate simcha of being Jewish. When one does a mitzvah, does something which is correct and right and appropriate, but only because of the intellect, so the action is lacking. It's still, you know, it's still a mitzvah, and God gives you credit, and it's the right thing to do, but it becomes very dry. You know, it's a duty that we're doing. It's more that it's we're disciplined people, but it doesn't bring us joy. It doesn't inspire us or give us much passion. It's discovering the pure hearts within that want to connect with it. You know, with your pure heart wants so badly to do what's right, and we struggle with uncovering our pure hearts. If we can uncover our pure hearts and then do what's right, then it hits both our mind and our hearts. We feel it in the emotion, we feel it in the intellect, and then we feel a true happiness. Interestingly. This is, you know, you could take it or leave it. It's a cute thought. But we know there's a concept on Purim of drinking. You know, practically, do it, not do it, different issue. But there's a concept, it's quoted in the Gemara, of drinking on Purim. And it's strange. Like, you know, we understand the concept, you know, having a drink, feeling a little bit loose or happy. But the Gemara really describes it to an extreme. You know, you drink until you no longer can distinguish between the cursed Haman and the blessed Mordechai. I mean, that's a pretty far-off level of drinking. And probably you'd be passed out before you actually get to that point. What does the Gemara mean exactly? So forget practically what it means. Let's think about it conceptually. Now, we're talking right now about using the heart and not the intellect. When you drink, so you are removing your intellect and really functioning much more on emotion. Somebody who has had a lot to drink, their intellect is not what's guiding them at that point. It's their emotion guiding them at that point. Adilo yada, the way the Gemara describes it, until you don't know, it means until your intellect is kind of switched off and you're working on emotional mode instead of intellectual mode. You're working on the heart more than the mind. The idea of drinking overall does it to a person. People become, for better or for worse, you know, become very emotional when they're drinking. So some people become very happy, some become very, very depressed. But, you know, the emotions come out when they're drinking. But it's not the intellect, it's the emotions. So, because Purim is a day of emotion, Purim is a day of passion, Purim is a day where we should try to achieve real emotional connection to Judaism and to Torah and to God, not just intellectual. If you can discover your pure heart and uncover it, then you act with the love and the excitement. That's what we act with. So this is Purim. This is what Purim is all about. Purim is about developing a day. It's a day of love of people, love of God, love of Torah. That's what Purim is about. When you give shalach manis to others, you're trying to increase your love of fellow Jews. When you're giving your gifts to the poor, also you're increasing your love of other people. When you celebrate Purim, you're increasing your love of God the Jews on Purim that said, the rabbis teach us, they recommitted themselves to Torah from love. It's a day where we're supposed to bring out the love on all sides. The you know, you have the love which goes upwards to God, which goes, you know, horizontal to other people, and then it goes into ourselves. We appreciate who we are as well. We appreciate our pure hearts. It goes in all directions. But that's what Purim is about. You know, if we could take the day and use it properly. So if we can really feel this inspiration and passion and joy, and there are a lot of ways to do it on Purim. Everyone has their own methods within it and the ways they celebrate. But through our celebrations that we have, it's so important to bring out this passion, this emotion. So another element of the Simcha, the month of Adar, is this is a much deeper understanding, but it's the way that we can, it's the bringing out in the person of passion and emotion in being Jews. It's letting the intellect not guide us, but being able to have the intellect go down into our hearts and have our heart guide us as well. And that's the important. That's a very important part of Purim, and this is how we can fulfill ultimately this verse we mentioned before: "Libi usar yarnu kelchoy," that my heart and my flesh, they should all sing out in joy to living God. And that's our true goal in Purim. At the end of the day, you should feel that not just did I do what I was supposed to do, but that I feel very happy and emotional and passionate about what I did. That's our goal.